up here, and for those who don't have perfect memories, I've been teaching a lesson series, a year-long lesson series. We're right now pretty much in the middle of part two of that lesson series of why I believe the Bible. The series started with why I believe a God exists. What proof and evidence is there that a God exists? And step two is that transition from, well, a God must exist, but many different people believe in many different gods. Which is the right God, or which is the right Bible that describes which is the right God? And so we narrow down on the Bible and how the Bible stands out among other books as a book of divine origin. And we're going through discussing the evidences, the proofs that lie in the Bible, in order to explain why we are God-fearing, Bible-reading Christians. And we're going to go into the first of three of the main categories of biblical evidence that I like to teach on this topic. The first being scientific knowledge, or some would say scientific foreknowledge, scientific accuracy. That is, man knowing something of a scientific nature, or knowing how the world works, how the laws of nature apply to the natural world before secular knowledge. That is, man acquiring knowledge that he himself did not obtain. Kind of like telling somebody about what happens in a movie before they see it, right? Man has been given this knowledge without him studying it, researching it, experimenting, etc. So the Bible is full of such instances of scientific knowledge that man could not have come to by himself. The second one being historical accuracy, you know, reconciliation with archaeological evidences and historical documents. Prophecy, how it's been realized, how it's been proven, the divine revelation of future events, and the accuracies of the prophecies. Those are the three main categories. And tonight we're going to talk about scientific knowledge. And looking at my lesson plan, I still have four more Sundays to preach on the subject of why I believe in the Bible. And even that's not enough time. What put together, that's about 2 hours of discussion. And even then, that's going to be summarized information. So if we don't hit on everything regarding scientific foreknowledge tonight, there's really a lot of information on the subject. And the Bible itself, it's not written, of course, as a textbook. It's not presented to us as an encyclopedia of natural history of the ancient world. But we recognize it as a divinely inspired book, and that would mean accuracy. Speaking in terms of accuracy whenever making statements that contain scientific knowledge, leaving out superstitious fallacies typical of man's stories, of man's contrivances, of man's ideas. And whenever men write books of knowledge or books of learning, it doesn't take long before it gets outdated or proven wrong. We look at some of the ancient Greek philosophers and some of their ideas that they had, and they were leading men at the time. And of course, their ideas quickly became dated. And the Bible's full of proof of knowledge, like I said, that it was unavailable to ancient man, yet it's present in the Bible. It stands out as one of the clear evidences of divine inspiration. And one of the sections that's always fun to talk about is the idea of germs. And this idea of germs, it's something that we know about scientifically today, but for the vast majority of human existence, at least in any documented form, there's been no theory or knowledge presented on this idea of germs. And in the Bible, God did not discuss in detail the existence of germs with Moses. He did not sit him down and give him a science lectureship course on germs. We don't see the word germs. You know, secular man didn't know how to talk about it until recently. And I suppose that's kind of like how we teach our kids to wash their hands before they understand the concept of things getting in their body to make them sick and how living organisms can be tiny, etc. You know, the people back in the day did not have to know all the scientific knowledge or did not have to understand it and know it in order to follow the commands God gave them. God gave commands to Israel that show a complete knowledge of germs that's not found in any other contemporary civilization, that there is no one around for them to get it from. There is no means for them to obtain the knowledge themselves at that time. Germs were not known to secular science until about the mid-1800s, and much to man's detriment. Man did not know for thousands of years that cleanliness and health were closely tied together, were closely related. But we see, especially with the laws that Moses gave to the Israelites from God, many commands having to do with cleanliness, having to do with the handling of dead bodies, like we see in Leviticus 21 and Numbers 19, the strict rules, not just human bodies, but different types of carcasses of different animals, and how to clean themselves, how they were considered unclean until a certain amount of time had gone by, in addition to the washing of oneself. I mean, the Bible even includes recipes for cleaning agents. They were to have this water of purification, and it wasn't like some of the crazy stuff you see the ancient Egyptians had at that time, which Moses was raised in Egypt, and the Israelites came out of Egypt, yet the law that Moses gave to the Israelites doesn't reflect the, you might say, superstitious trial and error ideas that were in some of the Egyptians' manuscripts for health, healing, and herbs and stuff like that. But they had cleaning agents that were caustic. They mentioned ashes, water that's been run through ashes, which draws out the lye, which is a caustic agent that kills microbiological organisms. And it uses hyssop, which has antiseptic, antiviral properties. We see that in Numbers 19 when they talk about this cleaning agent that also included agents for scrubbing and exfoliation and all kinds of ideas that were alien to the world, alien to the secular world at that time. We see rules for what they could eat, what they could put in their bodies. Now, why would God come up with all these rules for his people? Is there some sort of spiritual connection besides, you know, obeying the God and the rules that he set forth? Is there some sort of spiritual something that's bad for your soul in the food that you eat? He came up with all these rules and regulations for them because they were God's people. He had to set them apart. And part of that means not having epidemics, not having these outbreaks or large groups of people getting sick and dying because of what they're eating, because of what they were doing, which would show that they did not, in fact, have divine leadership if the God leading them allowed them to do these things that would result in, you know, large groups of people being harmed around, you know, because of sickness, because of food poisoning, because of whatever. So it was also a sign to other nations that a divine, intelligent presence was leading the people by the laws that he gave them that caused them to be healthier, to not have, you know, STD outbreaks or diseases, viruses. Now, today, food, of course, is a very heavily regulated industry. By law, different states have different laws. There's also federal laws, very heavily regulated. Most of the food that we get in the United States is pretty much gone through the gamut of making sure it's safe for human consumption. Whenever, like any little outbreak, there's always these large food recalls, whatever it is, you know, cabbages, meat. And so, you know, it's for good reason. Because you can make a lot of people sick, even just at one event. If one little thing is poison, you can make a bunch of people sick. And this was also true of God's people. Right? all these things that could make you sick still existed or were in existence at that time. They were given this list of clean and unclean foods. We could go through and just read straight from the Bible of all the animals they said they could eat. And they're not really presented with reasons why they shouldn't. And a lot of times they might not have been able to understand at that time, like we do with modern science, with knowledge of bacteria within meat or within just some of the animals naturally have bacteria in them. But they were given a list of clean and unclean foods. And this list still makes sense today. It's still true today. Even when scrutinized by experienced dietitians, they say, yeah, this is still a healthy way to eat. And they were given this list of animals that they are perhaps attributes of animals that they were not geographically in contact with, but the laws applied to all animals of that type. One such category that's of interest is sea creatures. When he talks about the things that live in the sea is very vast, and even nowadays we're still discovering creatures or species that we didn't even know existed until recently, and there's no way at that time that they could have knowledge of everything that lives in the sea. So from man's point of view, you know, how would you come up with a rule or a list of rules that covers everything that lives in the ocean if you don't have complete knowledge of everything that lives in the ocean? And most notably, the rules about that was the fins and scales rule. If it was clean to eat in the ocean, it had to have both fins and scales. There are some creatures that have fins but no scales, and there are some creatures that have scales and no fins. And we know that they are not really safe for human consumption. There are some that are considered specialties that, with modern contrivances and technology and sanitary practices, some of that food is made safe for human consumption, but there's still a threat, such as shellfish. Shellfish have to be cooked properly. They have to be cooked thoroughly because you could get sick from it pretty easily. Eating raw shellfish talks about the puffer fish is a specialty, a delicacy in Japan. It has to be prepared by a licensed chef. And even then, sometimes it can go wrong because it's full of toxicity. It has fins, but it doesn't have scales. Even the catfish, a very popular dish in the South. The catfish, because it's a bottom feeder, it's considered unclean. It has fins, but it doesn't have scales. It feeds off of the things that die and float down to the bottom of the river, pretty much anything it can. So it's not, like I said, it's not a rule that just applies to local species, but species that were not indigenous to the area that the Israelites lived in at that time. It's a law that was given that's true for everywhere in the oceans, even with what we know today of all the species we know through exploration and science. This rule still applies. It still shows a divine source of knowledge. Knowledge beyond man. The book of Levi, it mentions the fins and scales in chapter 11. It also mentions reptiles. It mentions some reptiles by name. Let's go ahead and go there, if you will. Right after the sea creatures, I do believe. Did I lose it? Must have been. I seem to have lost the place where it was written. Oh, here it is. And starting in verse 29 of chapter 11, it says, "These also shall be unclean to you among the creeping things that creep on the earth, the mole, the mouse, and the large lizard after its kind, the gecko, the monitor lizard, the sand reptile, the sand lizard, and the chameleon." So he mentions a lot of reptiles. And what they didn't know today that we know nowadays is the existence of salmonella. And reptiles are very famous as being carriers for salmonella. Even if they don't have it, it's estimated that around 90% of reptiles are natural carriers for salmonella. It's so much so, and it's not just eating, but handling reptiles, you can get, or handling something that a reptile has touched, you can get salmonella. The CDC recommends that homes with children under 5 recommends that they don't have reptiles for pets just because of this proliferation of salmonella among reptiles. And yet we see here, thousands of years ago, before they knew about salmonella, he's very vehement, mentions a lot of, you know, the lizards here. Pretty much anything that falls into the lizard or amphibian category is considered unclean. And now we know because it probably has salmonella. And he talks about a lot of other unclean animals that we look at through the modern prism of science. We know are unclean that have to have special preparation, like the pork that we eat in the United States. You know, like I said, the food is heavily regulated by laws. The way that the pigs are kept and fed and looked after, and then the meat brought to market. You know, it's to the point where it's safe for human consumption, but they still say make sure it's cooked thoroughly. There's no eating raw pork or undercooked pork like you can with beef. And there's a lot of other unclean animals it mentions that we know nowadays make perfect sense, like bats are known for, infamous for rabies. But not even just eating them, but handling them. So again, he shows all this knowledge that man did not have the means to come by on his own. God had to give it to him in order for them to be able to know what to put in their bodies, what not to put in their bodies. And as we mentioned in previous lessons, the Bible teaches the laws of science. Talking about animals, one of the most notable, you know, that we've touched on before, the Bible talks about the law of biogenesis, this idea of life from life, kind from kind. That's very important. That's very singular. Even going back to that time period when Moses wrote about each producing after its own kind, created after its own kind. You know, in man's myths, what do we see? Whenever man writes about mythological histories or stories or epics, man's myths are full of crossbreeds or mixed beasts or beasts, you know, animals, creatures that can't exist in real life, like the minotaur or the centaur or the mermaid or the griffin, which is like a half lion, half eagle, or the chimera, etc., etc. We see all these creatures that are, we know, to be scientific impossibilities because they're a mixing of the kinds. Even in some of today's popular sci-fi, they still have these ideas of half human, half something or whatever, which we know is a scientific impossibility. And you don't see any of those throughout any of the Bible. The Bible doesn't, in one place, promote the idea of some creature mixed of different kinds, that at least not in any kind of literal form. So that's another way that the Bible stands out. It promotes and it consistently teaches and does not contradict the laws of science. The Bible describes cosmological truths and evidences, such as the stars being uncountable. As God challenges Abraham in Genesis 15:5, he challenges them to count the stars because they are innumerable. Even as late as the early 1900s, secular man has been attempting to count them. And it was until, I guess, about 100 years ago or so, you know, as our technology increased to the point where we can take pictures of distant stars, we know that there's billions upon billions of stars in the galaxy. There are too many to count. Yet ancient man knew that because God said it to him. God challenged him, said, can you count the stars in the sky? We also know that the Israelites practiced quarantine procedures and ideas such as covering one's mouth to prevent the spread of illness. It's something, you know, we don't even think about today, but secular man for hundreds of years, maybe thousands, you know, didn't know about this kind of stuff like we do today. Like, what is it parents are always telling their kids? Cover your mouth when you cough. Cover your mouth when you sneeze. Let's go to Leviticus 13, starting in 45. It reads, "Now the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn and his head bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, 'Unclean, unclean.'" If someone approached him, he was to cover his mouth. This idea of preventing the spread of disease or germs through, you know, heavy breathing, spit, saliva, or whatever. And then in verse 46, "He shall be unclean all the days he has a sore, he shall be unclean. He is unclean and he shall dwell alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp." This idea of quarantine, of isolating someone who has a sickness, of having them cover their mouth so they don't contaminate other people. This was, of course, many years before man came about such ideas by himself. In fact, the word quarantine wasn't used until the late Middle Ages, in which they saw that, you know, people were coming in from distant lands with diseases and getting other people sick. And they didn't know what the cause of it was, but they saw the result. And so they would have when a boat would come into port, it would be isolated for, what was it, something like 40 days. Where they get the word quarantine is from that word 40. And they would isolate them for a certain amount of time to make sure that they did not have a sickness before they let them mingle with the population at large. Also, and pretty importantly, God's rules about marriage versus STDs. Again, the CDC comes into play here in admitting that the best way to prevent and eradicate STDs is to, quote, abstain from sexual contact or to be in a long-term mutually monogamous relationship. That sounds a lot like what we see the prescription is for man, as set forth by God, to abstain unless you're in that exclusive relationship called marriage, mutually monogamous, long-term mutually monogamous, another way to say married for life. STDs are spread through sinful acts, sexual immorality. God's rules prevent STDs. So once again, God's rules that he set forth, not just for the ancient Israelites, but for all men, made sense, and they make sense today. It's still true that abstinence is, you know, the best practice. Before you're married, abstinence is the best practice, not just for STDs, but, you know, for all kinds of drama and hassle that might fall out in your life. Just, it's always good to wait. This is for all you teenagers out there, some young kids, Alice. You know, it's interesting to note that when man makes discoveries, right, he often becomes famous, gets his name written in a book. If you study the history of cosmology, you'll come across certain names like Copernicus and Galileo, etc. When man makes discoveries, he becomes famous for it. But the Bible is filled with knowledge, and the writers write about it in a very matter-of-fact way, as if it's just knowledge that is true, and that the discovery does not lie with them, like such as the scripture about how the earth is an orb suspended in the heavens by nothing, hanging on a thread, so to speak, whereas man for thousands of years thought it was flat, thought it was held up by Atlas or a giant turtle, or that the sun rotated around the earth, etc. And yet the Bible writers clearly understood the nature of the earth and its relationship to other bodies in the heavens in our solar system. The Bible is filled with knowledge that took secular man hundreds and sometimes thousands of years to arrive at. Knowledge that is never outdated, unlike man's continually revised ideas and perceptions. How many revisions do the school textbooks go through, especially if you're buying college textbooks and you buy your book, and the next year that you need to use it, it's outdated, and you have to buy the new revised version. How many editions do they go through as man continually finds new information or discovers that old information was indeed false? Yet the knowledge that the Bible contains within it does not go out of date, does not need revision, does not become obsolete or contradicted. Moses' rules for dieting, for cleanliness, they still work perfectly today. You can abide by the rules that you see set forth in Deuteronomy and live a healthy life. It's still true. Knowledge of how laws govern the natural world, they're throughout the Bible. They're found throughout the Bible. They are harmonious with the knowledge in the Bible. And they were put in the Bible long before they were discovered and stated by man. The Bible treated it as a matter of fact. Cosmological knowledge not known to ancient man because he didn't have the means to know it, did not have the technology to know it, was understood by the writers of God's word, such as describing the earth as an orb suspended by nothing. Knowledge of divine nature. That is what the Bible is filled with. When we're looking at scientific proof, scientific evidences, there is no contradiction. There's only knowledge. This is the first pillar or the first major category that I like to discuss when I would teach the teenage class. We would go through this. And it really is a lot of fun to go through and just see how everything lines up scientifically. Historically, prophecies. Next week we'll be talking about history, but there's so much more we could talk about. I'm sure we could not just do a sermon, but we could fill a class series with just, a part of a section of scientific proofs and evidences that the Bible's filled with, all kinds of things that man wrote about through divine inspiration that we didn't know secularly until modern or recent times. The Bible talks about large creatures that we didn't know about until the 1800s, and we started calling them dinosaurs. It's a very interesting study. I hope to have piqued your curiosity with this lesson tonight. That is the lesson that I have prepared for you tonight. If there is any here who wish to be added to the body through baptism, if there's any here who need any prayers of the congregation, please let that need be known as we stand to sing the song of invitation.